From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. Later in the broadcast, the unique history of African Americans in World War I and a famous but unofficial truce that took place during that war. But first, the battle to maintain and upgrade some of the most critical infrastructure in the D.C. region, our water systems. Morning commuters were severely disrupted last week when a water main break flooded the metro system. All this happened the same week some residents were advised not to drink their water after an oily smell was detected in the Logan Circle and Shaw neighborhoods. We're joined now by the head of D.C. Water, which is simultaneously working to preserve and maintain infrastructure that affects every person who lives and works in the city, all the while working on some of the most ambitious plans anywhere in the United States to develop new public infrastructure. George Hawkins joins us in studio. He's the general manager of D.C. Water. George, good to see you.
Great to be back.
You launched an investigation last week to determine the source of what appeared to be oil in the water flowing into some homes in my old neighborhood around Logan Circle and Shaw. What have you found?
It was, we got the alert at 3 o'clock or so, 2 to 3 o'clock on Wednesday. The original mobilization was actually the Department of Environment, the fire department, and got very help, a good help from the civil support team at the National Guard. So they deployed first in case, because it was a petroleum smell, the question was it a sort of a catastrophic or potentially flammable event? We, of course, mobilized immediately thereafter, and I think I drove up to the site within that hour. What we had found was that we had what the expert said was a long-chain hydrocarbon, some sort of petroleum contaminant in a few of the samples. And this is where the civil support team from the National Guard was so important, because they had monitoring equipment right on their truck. This is the sort of truck that might mobilize to any kind of chemical problem in the city. And they were great in their support of us in this situation. What those monitoring events show is the presence of a contaminant, but not how much. DC Water takes the safety of our customers as its highest priority. So as soon as we had these reports of this petroleum smell in the water samples, we called this alert, the do not drink, do not use, do not wash with the drinking water. And we immediately started doing testing in a variety of different places to determine a perimeter and add what I would call a safety margin to hope we got the entire area. That changed somewhat over this 2.5 days of the alert. We were always doing our best, and if we had any indication we had gotten we needed to add on, we erred on the side of adding additional blocks, which we did to the margin at the edge. And then we started to investigate where this petroleum would have come from.
Indeed. What are some of the things that could contribute to something like this happening? What kind of forensic work does an investigation like this involve?
It's a very, very intensive forensic effort, as one might guess, and it's not something that's easy to happen. This is not something infiltrating into the sewer system, which, except in a big storm, a sewer pipe is mostly empty with the flow at the bottom. So there's a lot of sort of pull for anything that's in the ground around a sewer to get in it. A water system is the opposite. It's closed, it's pressurized. And as we know from the event earlier in the week, when a water main breaks, it is shooting water out, not adding water into the pipe. So it's not easy to get contaminants into a drinking water pipe. The two primary ways it can happen is, first, is there a water main break or a pressure loss for some reason that would have caused the pressure in the pipe to drop? And that might cause a contaminant that's outside the pipe to go into it. Okay. We actually did have a water main break at the far corner of the area the day before. Yeah. And very interestingly, there was a Washington Gas issue in that area. So we had a potential story for where the contaminants could have come from on that score. The second is something called in the business a cross connection. And this occurs, and it's part of the plumbing code, so it's something that's understood as a conceivable problem, although very rare. And any building, for example, that has a boiler in the basement that will do a regular cleaning scheme with a pressurized flow to clean out that sort of apparatus, there's the possibility that that pressure flow can actually be pushing back up in the water line into a water main, which is why the requirement for those systems is to have what's called a backflow preventer. Some may remember that that was the phrase we were originally using in Bloomingdale when we had floods in Bloomingdale. Those are actually called back water valves. Interestingly, when you have something to stop flow going backwards on the sewer line, it's called a back water valve. When you have something stopping backflow in a drinking water valve, that's what's called a backflow preventer. But if someone does not have a backflow preventer or does not maintain it properly, then that flow can flow backwards. The challenge of that second scenario is that could be in any basement of any of the buildings in the in this area. It was about 600 buildings, ultimately, that we had called this alert on, just more, slightly more than that. So you'd have to find the exact basement with the exact building for where this could be. A third possibility, although, again, it's hard to determine how it would have gotten in, is with a tremendous amount of construction that's happening in that several-block radius. So we started investigating lot by lot. Our first priority was to go door by door to alert our customers that this risk was out there, because we didn't want, the safety of our customers is always the first job. Then the second was, as we worked with the Department of Environment, we looked at every lot. Where would there be boilers? Where was there gas stations? Where could there be a past problem? And we started going lot by lot to try to find where this source might be.
You have not yet discovered exactly where the source might be.
We have not. In this kind of situation where, as I said, these are called cross connections, it's cross connecting something into the water system that we would not want to be there. It doesn't happen a lot anywhere in the country because, as I said, the water system is pressurized. When it does, it is always hard to find these sources. They can be ephemeral. It could be something that happened one day in a basement and then was cleaned up. And even if we got to that basement and assessed it, by the time we got there, everything would be have been cleaned
because
up.
Because now it seems to have stopped. How does DC Water go about determining that water is once again safe for use and for drinking?
That's a great question. What we did throughout the two and a half day period is we were taking monitoring samples from a series of places around in the sector, particularly in the areas where we had had reports of the petroleum smell. There were other parts that we didn't have reports, but we felt on a hydraulic basis it was safe to include them in the safety zone. But we took monitoring results, and we sent them to two labs, one at the aqueduct, which is the water treatment facility for Washington, D.C., and also somewhat for Fairfax and Arlington, and also to a lab that the U.S. EPA runs in Fort Meade, Maryland. And the first day, those results did not come back clean, which is why, even though we were flushing the system, because the typical way when there's this ephemeral source in this kind of situation that's gotten into the system, we flush at night through fire hydrants to get water out and bring fresh water in. And we still were getting slight hits of some contaminants in some of the sites on Thursday, which was that first day. So we continued the alert till Friday. We flushed all night Thursday night. And then we did another round of testing on Friday morning, and it's those tests, all of them, that came back clean for hydrocarbons that allowed us to call off the alert.
Our guest is George Hawkins. He's the general manager of DC Water. If you have questions, give us a call. Were you among those affected by the Do Not Drink Water Advisory last week in the district? What questions do you have about the things that affect the safety of your water? 800-433-8850 is our number. You can send email to culture@wamu.org. There's also the matter of the water main break that flooded the metro system last week. You mentioned that. It's my understanding that the pipe that broke was laid down in the year 1953. How does that compare to the age of other pipes in the system?
That's actually, and this is sort of a remarkable statistic, but that's one of our newer pipes. The median age, and I'm always reminded by my more scientifically oriented colleagues, that median means half of your sample is older than that and half is less old, is 79 years. So that means half of the water pipes we have in Washington, D.C. are older than 79 years, which is sort of a remarkable statistic. 1953 means this is 60-plus years old, which is still old, but it's one of our younger pipes. But there's a lot of factors that go into whether a pipe will break or not. The pressure on the road above, that's a major thoroughfare, obviously, so it takes a lot of heavy traffic above the pipe and below the pipe with metro, what's in the soil conditions around it, the pressure that's in the pipe and how much it serves. So while most of the pipe breaks we have are probably in pipes older than that, that particular pipe wasn't one of our older ones in the inventory.
What kind of effort is it going to take to replace or to upgrade the infrastructure behind D.C.'s drinking water and sewage systems?
It takes a great effort, and I want everyone listening to realize how much D.C. Water apologizes for these events. We take great pride in the service that we deliver. Our employees work incredibly hard. We're mindful that we're paid for by our ratepayers. So we are a public agency. We are a reflection of the people we serve, and it's our determination to provide clean, safe water 24 hours a day, clean it 24 hours a day, and deliver it through a system that works. And it's tremendously distressing to us when it doesn't. Having said that, the reality of the current situation is, and this is a nationwide issue that's reflected in Washington, but it's true in almost every community across the country, is that most water systems and sewer systems were put in around the turn of the last century when cities were forming. Some is more modern when suburbs were forming after World War II, but even that is now 50, 60 years old. And when you first put in a system, and it has a long life. I mean, a pipe will have a 60, 70, 80-year life. For a long period of time, once you put it in, what you're charging your customer is the operating cost to operate that, but not the capital cost to replace it. So for many years, water and sewer service hasn't been that expensive because what we've, relatively speaking, I know to some people any charge is expensive, and I don't minimize that, but relative to other huge parts of infrastructure, it hasn't been expensive because all we've been paying is our operating costs. What has come due in our time is that we've got to replace, say, 80-year-old median pipes. We have pipes 100 years old, 120 years old, and we just have to get out there, dig up the street. Or we've actually used some new technology, which I can tell you about, which is really fascinating. But we need to replace. One of the things we're doing now instead of digging up the street is we're lining old pipes. It's this really fascinating resin. And you, instead of needing to dig a trench in the whole street, you have to put in a parallel line above ground so that you can route the water or sewer. It can be done for water or sewer lines. And then you put in this specialized resin that's just the right length for the period that you're – first you scour out the inside of the pipe to make it smooth. You put in a resin. It's hardened, and it essentially creates a brand new inner pipe on the inside of the older pipe. It's less expensive. It's faster to do. It digs up less streets. It takes less traffic consternation. So we're always trying to be very efficient and new in the manner in which we do this. We want to know what the latest world-class techniques are. The bottom line, however, is that what we're adding to our bill are capital costs that haven't been there. So the challenge with a customer is at the same time we're charging more money, because now we still have operating costs. We've got to run the system. We have to add capital costs to replace the system. And we're having these challenges with the services at the same time. And I think a natural customer response would be, well, why are you charging me more and the service keeps being disrupted?
You're charging you more because there are long-term issues involved here. And as you mentioned earlier, these are national infrastructural issues, but in some cases, they have to be dealt with at the local level. And last summer, D.C. Water was pitching investors on essentially making a 100-year bet on the city's environmental infrastructure. How did things end up going with the sale of the so-called green bonds?
That was a great innovation, and our CFO, Mark Kim, may be listening. I want to send my shout-out to him. He's brought incredible innovations on the financial front. What I want to assure our customers is that we are doing everything and innovating in every way we can. It doesn't matter what part of our business it touches. If there's a manner that we can deliver service more cheaply or more effectively than we do now, we want every dollar to go farther, even as we are collecting more dollars than we have in the past. The Century Bond was a fascinating question. And we've talked about this before, Kojo, when we're doing our deep tunnel project. This is a gigantic project to build underground tunnels, 10 stories underground. So build a 10-story building straight down. That's where our tunnel is. It's bigger than a metro tunnel, so they're huge. And we have one that we have a current machine that's almost made its way up to Poplar Point. We just christened a second machine called Nanny, after Nanny Helton Burroughs, which is going to go down at RFK Stadium. It's going to drill south, and it's going to be like the trains meeting when they cross the United States. These tunnel boring machines will meet around Poplar Point. And that's going to, this is an enormous construction project to take combined sewer overflow that otherwise goes to our rivers. So an incredible improvement to the city, but as one could guess, massively expensive. So the question was how to finance it. And we're very aware that our current ratepayers are being asked for an upgrade to infrastructure, a problem of which dates at least 100 years into the past. Our solution will last 100 years into the future. Engineering firms, both private and on staff, said that this deep tunnel that we're building has a minimum 100-year lifespan. So what we asked ourselves was, usually when you do debt financing, so you're like a house, you're going to finance the cost of this over many years. It's 30 years or maybe 35 years. But if it has a useful life of 100 years, and it's solving a problem that's 100 years in the past, why should we make a 30-year group of ratepayers on their shoulders cover a 200-year issue? So we actually felt it was much fairer to ratepayers to spread out the cost over the expected life of the deep tunnel, which is 100 years. So that was where it came with a century bond.
If my grandchildren are going to enjoy it, let them pay help to pay for it.
Help pay for it. And in most cases, you don't want to push off costs to future generations unless by design that which you are building
benefit them.
It will absolutely benefit. So it's fair for them to help contribute, not just to saddle it all on this particular group of customers who happens to be alive now. It had never been done before, a century bond. The other part, which you mentioned, is it's a green bond. We had it certified as a green project because this deep pipe is going to do such incredible benefit to the Anacostia and ultimately the Potomac and the Rock Creek, although we have some ideas on that front. And the good news is that for the first time this has ever been issued from a water authority, we were going to go to market for $300 million of financing to help this project. And the interest rate dropped because there was so much investor interest in this century bond that we were able to reduce the interest that we were paying on the bond on the day of sale. We had just about $1.1 billion in buy orders for what we ended up sizing at $350 million of bond. It's just like any product. If you have more buyers than sellers, your price gets better. So we actually saved our ratepayers something like $6 million on the day of sale because we had so much interest in these bonds.
I can't stand how much you seem to enjoy doing this job. We're going to be having a new administration coming in to the city next year. Do you expect to be staying on in your jobs? Have you had conversations with incoming Mayor Muriel Bowser about what she may feel are the most critical aspects of your mission, what you have to do? Because I've been hearing scuttlebutt that she's been talking to you about something else. But go ahead, please.
I am very excited. I want to state very clearly that this will be my third mayor I hope to work with. I very much enjoyed working with Mayor Fenty. I've really enjoyed working with Mayor Gray and his city administrator.
You're enjoying it all way too much, but go ahead.
Well, they've just been good. We've been working together to get things done for the city, which is, and I'm very much looking forward to working for the mayor-elect Bowser. She and I worked together when I was at the Department of Environment, and I think the technique that she used was to get knowledgeable on the topics. This was a contamination question in a neighborhood called Riggs Park. She and I would go to public meetings together. She had courage in front of the public as well as with us. She was tough on the city to get things done, but fair. So I'm tremendously encouraged. Having Councilmember Wells come on as Department of Environment Director is fantastic. He's a good friend and ally. So I have talked with her over the years. In the last few weeks, I have not talked with her about D.C. water priorities, although I know that will come.
But you have talked with her.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm very much looking forward to her administration. I think the city will continue to move forward. My personal position at D.C. water is actually appointed by the board.
Okay.
So my general sense of any of these jobs is that if you're in a city where the city doesn't want you, whether the mayor appoints you or not, you wouldn't want to stay in the job. There's just too much you have to do with the city.
Suffice it to say that what we know is that the city wants to continue working with George Hawkins, but George Hawkins wants to continue in the kind of position that he is in now. Is that a fair statement to make?
That is. I think I can do the best for the city. We're running a multi-billion dollar capital program. We're trying to upgrade the water and sewer systems in the street. We are trying to deliver good, safe drinking water. We have to make tough decisions every day. And I,
in other words, he could have had another job, but he didn't want it. Governing Magazine recently named you as one of its public officials of the year. And the lead into their piece about you was all about how you like to wear the D.C. Water Utility uniform everywhere you go. Why do you wear the uniform? We assume it's got more to it than you thinking that it looks awesome.
I do think it looks awesome. I love my uniforms.
I fed you that.
The reason that I wear the uniform really comes down to, and I was very humbled. Anyone who says they don't like winning an award like the one you mentioned would be something wrong with them. On the other hand, I know that the only reason DC I would get an award like that is because DC Water, every employee performs so well. And no matter what I say here on your show, what I say at a boardroom, and the kind of work I do, I'm not the one who's out looking for a petrochemical contaminant in the street. I'm not the one flushing the lines. I'm not the one digging up the street. I'm not the one designing the deep tunnel project. I'm not the one doing the procurement. Almost the work of the enterprise is this enormous and powerful and dedicated team. And what I've found from people who do water and sewer, it's some of the best and most dedicated public servants I've ever been around. They know why they do their work. The water we deliver, it's essential to people's lives. It's essential to every job. Who gets to say that when they come in every day?
See, that's what I said. He enjoys this job way too much.
And I wear the uniform to remind myself, truly. Yeah. It reminds me who does the real work, and I honor them and respect them. Team Blue, as I call them, I hope they know how much I'm pleased to be part of the team with them, and that's why I
didn't know before, they know now. George Hawkins, he is the general manager of DC Water. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a delight to be here, always is.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, the unique history of African Americans in World War I and another unique, a famous unofficial truce during that war. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5. I'm Pat Brogan. 12:28 now, cloudy skies, 39 degrees. WAMU 88.5 and the National Theater are offering the chance to win tickets to see singer-songwriter John Prine. The performances are on May 8th and 9th. More information is at WAMU.org under events.
Down at the station, lights all aglow. Eight reindeer engines all raring to go.
On the next Fresh Air, Nick Lowe performs some original Christmas songs and some little-known ones in our studio. His latest album, Quality Street, features holiday songs. Join us.
Fresh Air starts at 2.
As you make year-end contributions to the organizations that are important to you, please include WAMU 88.5. Member support is the heart and soul of the station, and your year-end gift will make possible all the programs you count on in the year to come. Make your donation by December 31st to be eligible for a 2014 tax deduction. Call 800-248-8850 or go online at WAMU.org. Thank you.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Miriam's Kitchen. Committed to changing a system that tolerates chronic homelessness in Washington, D.C., Miriam's Kitchen is guiding people home through dignity, belonging, and change. More information at miriamskitchen.org.
This August, a sea of red poppies pouring out of the Tower of London marked the beginning of Europe's commemoration of World War I centennial. 14 million people lost their lives in the Great War, including nearly 500 from this city alone. It was a miserable conflict that was made even more so for the Africans and African Americans who fought bravely on both sides, even as discrimination entrenched itself in the muddy battlefields. And now, 100 years after they entered the conflict, a local historian is bringing the stories of those soldiers, black soldiers, back to life. We're exploring their lives and this week's 100th anniversary of the historic Christmas truth. Here to kick off the conversation is C.R. Gibbs. He's a historian and lecturer, author of 6 books, including Black Inventors and Black, Copper, and Bright, the District of Columbia's Black Civil War Regiment. C.R. Gibbs and I go back some 40 years. It's so good to see you again. The man who I knew and still know is Bob Gibbs. Good to see you.
I'm glad we're still around.
Well, if we're not, you're going to document it.
I tell you.
This year, marks a century since the start of World War I, and though the United States didn't get involved in the war until 3 years after it started, you say that Africans and African Americans bookended this conflict in a significant way. How so?
Absolutely. African troops were called in from 1914, and there were African Americans who, restless and eager to enter the fray, joined, for example, the famous No. 2 Construction Battalion in Canada. And so it's people think of it as a strictly Afro-Canadian unit, but there were African-Americans in the No. 2 Construction Battalion. There were lone adventurers such as Eugène-Jacques Boulard, who flew with the French Flying Service. And so we have on both sides, and the last troops to surrender flying under the flag of the German Imperial Eagle were African troops in East Africa. So we got bookends, as absolutely.
In preparation for the U.S. Centennial in a little less than 3 years, you're encouraging listeners to start digging through their family archives to see how their ancestors were involved in World War I. What role did this area play in preparing African American soldiers for war?
Well, for example, there's a first separate company out of Baltimore, and there is the esteemed 1st Separate Battalion that comes out of the District of Columbia. There were also a tremendous spurt of patriotism in Virginia. I just spoke about that at the Alexandria Black History Museum. And so Virginia African Americans were eager to demonstrate their patriotism in the years after the Civil War and the Spanish-American War.
We just found out over the weekend that President Obama approved the creation of a national World War I memorial, but it'll be an expansion of Pershing Park near the White House, which upsets a lot of people who say the memorial should be on the National Mall. What are your thoughts?
We have a clash. When good people of opposite intentions disagree, sometimes we can still shake hands over the basic intent. And in my judgment, the D.C. World War I Memorial should remain what it is. It commemorates the sacrifice of 500 folk. It's a reminder that 26,000 district residents fought in the war. And there is something else for those of you who peer into it. It's the first interracial memorial on the Mall. It is uniquely D.C. It is uniquely forward-looking in terms of its exposition about race. And it is a reminder that we have a forgotten World War I memorial up 16th Street. There were trees planted, Norway maples, and stone pillars about 2 feet high, and a copper disc from about Alaska Avenue down to Allison. Most of them are gone. They've disappeared over the years. Cars hit them, I think. Pedestrians may have felt a little too patriotic and snatched a few. But a few still remain. And as late as about 2000, there were one or two almost fully intact memorials. But the stone post in a few instances still remains.
Is there any place for or any memorial yet for the Africans and African Americans who fought in World War I?
The one thing that the district memorial does do, the city's World War I memorial, is it lists all the names of those who died without mention of race. So if you know who the person is you're looking for, particularly for the African Americans, since the story of the black troops from Africa and those from that are African American is not really being told, there's still a need to go find that history, much as is true when we look at the World War II memorial. There's nothing specifically on the special circumstances of men and women of African descent.
Our guest is C.R. Gibbs. He's a historian and lecturer, author of 6 books, including Black Inventors and Black Copper and Bright, the District of Columbia's Black Copper and Bright, the District of Columbia's Black Civil War Regiment. If you've got questions or comments for C.R. Gibbs, call us at 800-433-8850. Do you think history books often overlook African-American participation in our wars? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Thousands of African Americans enlisted to fight the Germans, but they faced just as much discrimination inside the service as they did in everyday life. Can you give us an idea of what life was like for those black men and for black people in general during the early 20th century?
World War I occurs against the backdrop of some of the most violent and racist periods in American history. Wilson clearly is not a friend. We have the the picture, Birth of a Nation, that which in and of itself sets race relations back and the study of decent history back a couple of decades, we find in the Army. Let me give you a local example. There is an esteemed scholar, Rayford Whittingham Logan, who taught at Howard for many years. He is so twisted because he nearly gets lynched, he gets attacked, he is verbally assaulted. Even as a man who attended Williams College and had the material to become a fine officer, but the Army High Command had absolutely no enthusiasm for black men wearing officers' bars, or let alone a leaf or an eagle. That was just unpalatable to them. So they went in and sought to erect barriers to black men who had sufficient education, who had what the Army might have considered too much initiative. It seemed as though they did not want those kinds of people, so they rejiggered the qualifications for the ages of people who sought officer training to weed out the younger and perhaps less malleable black men.
Rayford Logan is a legendary black scholar on the campus of Howard University and around the world. The NAACP at the time pushed for black officer training, but there were problems with that. What were they, and where were black officers trained?
They were trained way off in Des Moines, Camp Des Moines, Iowa, not around any black centers of population. But the idea struck at the heart of the NAACP's purpose, which was they fought against segregation. But given the unyielding racial attitudes of the time, they reluctantly decided that perhaps the very best compromise they could get out of it was a segregated officers' training camp. And several hundred officers would come out of that. It's useful to mention that before the war was declared, the National Guard unit of African Americans from the District of Columbia was the first called up to guard some of the government buildings and water supplies in the nation's capital. This is the 1st Separate Battalion, which trained at 1200 U Street Northwest in the
True Reformers.
That's right. So, you know, this was special to the citizens. It made the bomb of the Jim Crow attitudes in the Army a little bit more digestible. But it still was something that sort of shrouded every opportunity. It took 70 years for an African-American to be awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for service in World War I on a place called Hill 188.
You've got an incredible example of just how institutionalized discrimination was in the U.S. military during World War I. The African-American intellectual W.E.B. Du Bois leaked a secret memo containing the remarks of the head of the Allied forces at the time, John Pershing. What did Pershing say to the French who were stationed with the Americans?
He authorized the introduction of secret instructions that sought to implement a new kind of relationship between blacks and the French. It basically said that he even discouraged the shaking of hands. He didn't want black soldiers praised too much in front of white officers because it might upset them. And the main thing at the heart of this was no sexual connection between French women and black soldiers. And this is the thing that seemed to worry them the greatest amount. All of this, Du Bois leaked this near the end of the war, and it reveals the ugly underside of racial discrimination in the United States military at that time.
But publicly, Pershing's remarks were quite different.
After all, this was Black Jack Pershing, who made his bones serving with the Buffalo Soldiers during the frontier wars. And, of course, this is odd, since they were the best trained, best motivated a group of African-American men in the U.S. Army. They don't have a role in the trenches of World War I.
Here is Kirk in Manassas, Virginia. Kirk, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Doing well.
I'm glad you took my call so quickly. I'm pulled off on the side of the road. But I used to interview World War I veterans for about a decade, including a guy from Maryland who went and served against Pancho Villa. But that was not why I wanted to call. I was more interested in your guest's take on a group of soldiers that were made up of a motley bunch of Americans, which included Eugene Ballard, but also a guy named Scanlon, who was a boxer, and a couple others. There was a guy named those guys were all of African descent. But you also had, you know, a millionaire white New Yorker named Chad.
Where did they serve?
They served in France in World War One in one of the French Foreign Legion units. I don't know if it was the 2nd or the 3rd Regiment. But they show up in a book called The Vanguard of the Volunteers, which came out in about 1916. And there's a nice picture that has Ballard when he was in infantry uniform, as well as, you know, some of these other white and black Americans. And yeah. It's curious because they're integrated. And, of course, the U.S. Army was far, far from that.
French Foreign Legion.
Not on famously.
French Foreign Legion attracted a number of very interesting people.
Oh yeah. I mean, we even have, as late as World War II, we have African soldiers fighting in the French Foreign Legion. But the volunteers breathed a new kind of atmosphere in France. They were free of the mental shackles of Jim Crow. And so this provided them a way to build friendships that in many cases would last these men the literally the rest of their lives. And it showed the possibility of interracial cooperation. It should have shown it to the United States military. And the first group of black soldiers from the U.S. Were seconded to the French army when they came out of American soil.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation involving a great moment in World War I, during which an unofficial truce was declared, in which African-American soldiers also participated. But we're going to be right back. If you've called, stay on the line. We will get to your calls. If you'd like to call, the number is 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, the golden age of board games. Even in a tech-saturated world, classic games and some with new twists still animate family gatherings. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
And good afternoon. You're listening to the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5. I'm Pat Brogan. 12:43 now. Cloudy skies, 36 degrees. A freezing rain advisory is in effect until 6 tonight. Otherwise, cloudy with an 80% chance of rain. Freezing rain today, the high 37. Cloudy tonight with a chance of rain and patchy fog after midnight, low 34. Patchy fog tomorrow morning, then cloudy with a 30% chance of rain and a high of 44 expected.
Support your favorite shows on WAMU 88.5 by making a year-end donation. Gifts received by December 31st are eligible for a 2014 tax deduction at 800-248-8850 or at WAMU.org.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Catalog for Philanthropy Greater Washington, presenting its annual catalog that is a resource to the philanthropic community on nonprofits that serve the environment, arts, education, and human services. More at cfp-dc.org. And from your part-time controller, the Nonprofit Accounting Specialists, helping nonprofit organizations with all of their accounting and financial reporting needs. More at yourparttimecontroller.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about the centennial of World War I, which starts this year and is being celebrated around the world. We've been talking with C.R. Gibbs. He's a historian and lecturer, author of 6 books, including Black Inventors and Black Copper and Bite, the District of Columbia's Black Civil War Regiment. I should mention that soon available will be the commemorative booklet on the 40 years of home rule in the District of Columbia, 1974 to 2014. And that is also by C.R. or Carol R. Gibbs, the District of Columbia celebrating 40 years of home rule. But this week in particular is a special one because it marks 100 years since the historic Christmas truce along the border of France and Belgium. And joining us to talk about that is Stanley Weintraub, historian and author of more than 50 books, including A Christmas Far From Home, An Epic Tale of Courage and Survival During the Korean War, and Silent Night, the story of the World War I Christmas truce. Stanley Weintraub, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you.
C.R. Gibbs, our guest here in the studio, has been talking about the role of Africans and African-Americans in World War I. They were also apparently part of this truce, which started on Christmas Eve. Tell us more about their role and how this truce began.
The truce began without any warning on either side. The Germans erected Christmas trees, small tabletop Christmas trees, on their trenches. This was a tradition in Germany to have these yard-high tabletop trees. They were brought out by the Germans, complete with candles attached to them. And the Germans literally put them on top of their trenches, even though they worried that they'd be shot at. And they were. One German veteran of World War II, James Kruse, who became a friend of mine, told me about his uncle Otto, who was actually at the front at that time. Algerian troops faced the Germans on the British right flank, the 45th Division of the Army of Africa, which had fought at the Marne to help save Paris in early September. December 24th, their Christmas Eve, meant nothing to the Algerians, who were black and whose faith was Islam. And unaware of a holiday truce elsewhere, they fired at the Germans on Christmas Eve, endangering the people who were putting up their Christmas trees. And one of them, James Kruse's uncle Otto, told of a cook in his group who said, "No one can do this to me." And he rushed out in no man's land and ran toward the enemy lines. The Algerians were baffled by the apparition because the German appeared too crazy to shoot at and too comical to take seriously. After all, they didn't know anything about Christmas. They were all Islamic and black. They watched him in amazement, he wrote to me, until after a while the telephone began to ring inside the French trenches. Suddenly the Algerians became aware of the ceasefire, but the sergeant didn't stop until he was halfway between the lines. Then he set the tree down carefully, calmly took some matches, and lit the candles one by one and shouted, "Now you blockheads, now you know what's going on. Merry Christmas." And the enemy fire ceased in amazement.
Was this truce spontaneous, as some reports have indicated, or was it percolating before Christmas Eve since the trenches were so close?
The trenches were so close because of the stalemate between the lines all up and down the 300-plus miles from the North Sea to Switzerland. The weather was terrible. Much of it was soggy after rain and sleet and snow. Since shooting and advancing was really impossible, the troops began to have a ceasefire that was not declared in any way, but there was just no way to advance. And as a result, not only were those troops, the French and the Germans I just mentioned, involved in it, English troops farther up north were involved. The Germans were erecting Christmas trees there too. The British crawled out into no man's land, the 75 or 100 yards between both sides, to see what was going on. And the Germans, seeing that, crawled out toward them. And they met in no man's land, which was full of shell holes, filled with water, with the bodies of the dead that hadn't been collected. In the darkness of Christmas Eve, truces began up and down the line, complete to sharing Christmas gifts and chattering in both languages. And they decided, why not clear the no man's land in daylight once Christmas begins, and gather and fraternize and exchange gifts and food and play football, football meaning soccer.
Sure.
And up and down the line, they actually did improvise balls and play soccer up and down. The Germans won most of the games because they were far more professional, but nevertheless, it was a reality. They actually did play football. And the war diaries on both sides, which are in places like the Imperial War Museum, actually identify the troops that played football and even the scores of the games. And as a result, although some people think it was mythic, the results are there, and letters home from the soldiers to their families explain what happened, and they wrote such things as, you won't believe it, it was like a waking dream. But they did, and on the 11th of this month, a monument was erected in Belgium by the Football Association in Europe to the football played there. A shell on which a steel football.
But what happened when Christmas ended? Did the sides simply go back to fighting?
The weather continued so bad that they didn't go back to fighting except in very few places. Besides, the British celebrated the 26th of December as Boxing Day, which was a day when you gave out presents to servants, and the Germans celebrated what they called the second day of Christmas. So the day after Christmas remained peaceful. But gradually, the commanders on both sides insisted that the troops go back to fighting.
Were soldiers punished? Were soldiers punished or court-martialed for participating in the truce?
No one was actually court-martialed on either side for participating in the truce. Two British officers tried to establish a truce the following year in 1915 and were threatened with court-martial, but it never happened. It was quashed. And one of the two actually became a brigadier general later on in the war. So no one really got punished. But in order for the commanders to get the troops fighting again, they removed most of the troops who had been involved in the truces to the rear and brought in reserves from the rear who hadn't been involved with it and still were propagandized to hate the other side.
I should tell our listeners that they can hear more about the 1914 truce from Stanley Weintraub on Christmas Day, December 25th, on this station at 3 p.m. as part of WMU's special holiday programming. And you can find Stanley Weintraub's newly released book, A Christmas Far From Home, which examines the Korean War in 1950. That is available. You should also know that our other guest, C.R. Gibbs, is the founder of a lecture series that started in 1989 here in Washington, the longest continuously running lecture series on African-American culture and history. He's still giving monthly lectures on black history around the city. Here now is Kathy in Annapolis, Maryland. Kathy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks so much for taking my call. The subject of African-American infantry in World War I just recently came to my attention, and I'm quite interested in learning more because my mother, who is 80, mentioned to me that her dad, my grandfather, who I never had the privilege of meeting, not only was an officer in World War I, which I had known, and was mustard gassed, for which he got a Purple Heart. But in addition, she told me that he volunteered to lead an all-African-American regiment. And I thought this was fascinating information and something that I wanted to look into more. I wondered if your guest...
One of the things that C.R. Gibbs is encouraging people to do is look into their family history.
Yes, the National Archives has a program where you can share or actually interview a veteran. And I would recommend to you, one of the canons in the study of this is a book called Forgotten Soldiers. And you may well be able to make a connection about your family service.
Thank you very much for your call. Here is Walter in Manassas, Virginia. Walter, your turn.
Hello, Kojo. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Walter.
Okay. You got to come back to the Library of Congress. The women miss you.
Thanks. Thank you for that. I hope everybody misses me, but go ahead.
Okay. I just want to support some of the statements by the author that are accurate. My grandfather had a third-grade education. He left South Carolina, walked to New York City to join the Harlem Hellfighters, goes to Europe, and he always had a favorite song, How Can You Keep Them Down in the Fog Once They Have Been to Gay Paris? Annoyed my grandmother to no end.
You should see, you're cracking up C.R. Gibbs here, Walter. You better slow down.
Okay. Now, he said that he made that walk. He told my great-grandmother that he was going out to buy some milk, never came back, walked from Charleston to New York City because all the blacks had heard that Black Jack Pershing, who fought on the left flank of Teddy Roosevelt at San Juan Hill, was accepting troops, so they felt they could get a fair break. That regiment, the Harlem Hellfighters, received the Legion of Honor. Okay?
Yes.
But when they were reviewed by Black Jack, my grandfather said that Black Jack Pershing muttered under his breath the N-word as he was reviewing the troops. So my grandfather had great respect for him, but knew that he was a racist and told me so.
Apparently his public and private reputations were quite different.
They were at variance with one another. These troops, and one thing that I do have to say about the Harlem Hellfighters, I mean, we're talking about a unit, again, part of the outfit seconded to the French army. They spend more days in the trenches than anybody else. They survive and fight to the German border, to the Rhine. They are composed of Puerto Ricans as well as African Americans. So there are black Puerto Ricans in the regiment, which also reminds me that I have to give a shout out to the British West Indian Regiment, because these brothers from the islands did heroic service on a variety of fronts.
We're running out of time very quickly, but Stanley Weintraub, I know both you and CR were impressed this year by Britain's red ceramic poppies at the Tower of London commemorating the war. First, you, Stanley, what do you hope to see when the war centennial reaches the U.S. in 2017?
I think we'll see a spate of books equivalent to what are coming out right now. There'll be more books than anybody can possibly read.
CR, what are you hoping for?
I'm hoping that we somehow drill down into the popular consciousness so that we've already become aware of at least two diaries that we didn't already know about, that the information about the service and sacrifice of African and African American soldiers becomes much more widespread.
The attics are full of diaries.
Say that again, Stanley?
The attics are probably still full of diaries.
Yeah, the attics probably do contain a lot of diaries. I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. Stanley Weintraub joined us by phone from Newark, Delaware. He's a historian and author of more than 50 books, including A Christmas Far From Home, An Epic Tale of Courage and Survival During the Korean War, and Silent Night, The Story of the World War I Christmas Truce. And as I mentioned earlier, Stanley will be joining us on Christmas Day, December 25th at 3 p.m. as part of WMU's special holiday programming. You can hear more about the 1914 truce there. C.R. Gibbs is a historian and lecturer, author of 6 books, including Black Inventors and Black Copper and Bright, the District of Columbia's Black Civil War Resident. C.R., great to see you again.
Good
Happy
to see
holidays.
You.
Stanley Weintraub, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, Podcast Nation, niche audiences, old-fashioned storytelling, and compelling serials are making podcasts among the hottest properties on the Internet, Tech Tuesday explores. Then at 1, the rise of generics. Once the cheaper alternative to name-brand drugs, the prices of generics are spiking. A look at the multi-billion dollar industry. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
And good afternoon. You're listening to WAMU 88.5. I'm Pat Brogan. 12:59, cloudy skies, 39 degrees in Northwest Washington.
Today's programs are made possible in part by Amy Sabrin. And
thanks for listening to the Kojo Nandi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.